know there is so much power inside of you? You have the power to make an impact on the planet and the people around you just by believing in yourself. You get to decide how today, this year, this life is going to go. Are you feeding your old bad habits, or are you feeding your power? What's up, big dreamers? Your lady, Vitamin Katie, is here, and you are listening to my Feed Your Power podcast. I am a registered dietitian and fitness instructor, and my mission is to empower you to feel confident and excited about your health and your life. I know we're about to have so much fun together, so thank you for pressing play, and let's begin. Today, I have a special guest who's going to help us dial in what and how we can optimize not only our health, but also reverse environmental destruction and devastation. Kayla De La Haye is a scientist at the University of Southern California's Center for Economic and Social Research, where she directs the Institute for Food System Equity. She works to promote health and prevent disease by applying social network analysis and systems science to key public health issues. Her research engages family and community social networks and broader social determinants of health to promote healthy eating, nutrition security, and prevent chronic disease. It also explores the role of social networks in group problem solving in families, teams, and coalitions. This work has been funded by the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the American Heart Association. Dr. De La Haye was previously an associate professor of population and public health sciences at USC and worked as an associate behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. She currently serves as the vice president of the International Network of Social Network Analysis, INSNA, and in 2018, she received the INSNA Freeman Award for significant contributions to the study of social structure. She holds a PhD in psychology from the University of Adelaide, Australia. Get excited. This is a very informative and hopeful, like, have hope, people. You know, there's a lot that's going on. There's a lot that we can do. There's a lot of incredible public health professionals like Dr. Kayla De La Haye that are giving us the tools to really help improve not only our own optimal health, but also of the environment. I am so excited to have you with us today. Sustainability and public health are, of course, so important for the world, so important to me. And hearing that, you just said that you've worked mostly in the public health space rather than in the sustainability space. And I would love to hear all about that.
Yeah, I have worked the last 15 years in public health. I studied psychology and was looking at, you know, how do we decide what we eat? How do we help people make healthy decisions? And the more I worked in public health, the more I realized how hard it is for people to eat healthy, how confusing it is. But also, even when you know information, it's just really hard to do this. And for some people, it's because they're food insecure. For other people, it's because all the food around them that's convenient and cheap is not healthy. All the reasons differ. And more recently, I've started working a lot more with governments and local governments around what are the actual policies that are going to make our food system healthy, sustainable, last over the next few decades, and actually make it easier for people to eat like healthy, sustainable food.
Is there any particular venture that you're excited about right now that you're currently working on with that?
Yes, there's a few things. So one thing I'm really excited about is a lot of work I've been doing with local government in LA County and a bunch of great community organizations here. And last year, the county developed a strategic plan to build a healthier, more sustainable food system for LA. And so I worked with a group on the Food Equity Roundtable to help draft the strategic plan. And last year, our board of supervisors, like the head of government in LA County, approved it. And they're like, go and put this into motion. And What makes me excited about it is how big it is. It's like a really big vision. So there's things like, how do we get healthier food in schools? How do we support urban agriculture? How do we make the food system more equitable for farmers? But also things like government food programs and making those work better, thinking about how we as a county start procuring and bringing in more healthy, sustainable food. So it's really big and bold, and that's what makes me excited because a lot of things I've worked on, we work on little pieces of this problem, and it's really hard to make big changes. And so I'm really convinced what's needed is the whole county to like make a lot of big changes with people, with community organizations, with policies, with schools, and that's actually what's really gonna potentially transform our food system here locally. And I think it could be a really cool model for other cities or other places around the world.
Oh my gosh. Okay, everyone, take a deep breath. We are in the presence of a superhero here. Everything you're talking about is so big, like really so vast. This is not just I don't know how one person can possibly tackle these things. Every single thing that you listed, this is quite a vision. And I'm curious, yeah, how do you do this? Like, is it, I'm curious if you could outline further. What is that vision? Like, what was it before? And what are you creating? Like, what's the goal? How does that work?
For me personally, like my vision has shifted because so I've done a bit of work in LA County with home visiting programs, and we work a lot with low-income families just as they're bringing new babies home and they get some support in the first couple years of life. And
Oh, I love
we were
that.
work yeah it's such an important time to like work with families and really make sure they're supported and their kids are on these healthy trajectories. And in that work, we were doing a clinical trial of a new curriculum to help these families develop healthy eating habits and their kids to really develop that early.
Wow.
And I think so my vision at the start of my career and a lot of my work was to like really work with people and families and help them eat healthier and develop healthy habits. But for me, the vision has gotten bigger. Because in working with those people, I've realized how many different complex things, like all these different things that are in place that have to do with policy or have to do with how your community's planned or have to do with historical disinvestment in your community because of race and ethnicity and things like redlining. All those things matter so much to whether any one family I worked with could afford and get healthy food in a convenient, easy way that was like a good fit for their culture or their taste preferences. And so I think for me, my vision has gotten a lot bigger. A lot of what I do in my research is called systems science. So it thinks about, what are the whole big complex systems that are all working together that might impact any one family or person in their ability to eat healthy. So for me, my vision got a lot bigger because of those experiences, and the families I was working with all became food insecure during the pandemic. They had to go to line up and get on buses to food pantries every couple of weeks to feed their kids, and they really rely on programs like WIC, the government program for women, infants, and kids to give them extra money for food. So it did make me realize there's so many bigger things that matter to food access. And that's why I got more involved with folks working on these bigger picture issues. And I think you're really right. This is not something one person or one group of people can do. One of the things I really think is powerful in science is multi-sector and multidisciplinary research. So I work on projects with geographers, public policy experts, data scientists who work on really cool big data sets. And then we work with local government, with community-based organizations, with private business. And we're kind of one of the research projects we're working on, we're all working on this together to try to kind of get a better sense of the local food system and how it's changing.
Oh my goodness. It's so exciting hearing about this. I mean, personally, I have a very big vision. I think that the way food is subsidized right now, like I want to see regenerative practices being more
maybe subsidized. And of course, you know, in schools, in every grocery store, it is a business, right? So
Yeah.
they need to make ends meet while somehow still having really high quality food.
Yep.
And yeah, at grocery stores, and even if you're on a road trip, right, and you're trying to find something healthy to eat, or in any low-income community, gosh, I can't imagine the changes that need to be made. It feels very, very, very vast.
Yeah. One of the best descriptions I heard when I was first started studying public health and I was at a conference was the keynote speaker was talking about inequalities in health and why we have such big differences between certain groups of people in their health and diseases like heart disease and diabetes. And he said, if we had set out 50 years ago to design our cities and our country in a way that gave the most people diabetes possible, we would have done what we've done. We would have the cities that kind of look like how they do now. And they make it so easy, affordable, convenient to get really high processed, unhealthy food. And for certain people in particular who have less resources, less time, less money, it makes it really hard to even follow some basic dietary guidance and like eat healthy, sustainable food. So I think you're right. There's like really big changes that are needed because we've let different priorities really drive like what our food systems look like right now.
I'm part of a dietetics club here. I actually am in Colorado, and it's really interesting. Actually, here in Boulder, they do tax it's like sodas, and
Sugary drink.
yeah, which is
Yeah.
really interesting. But
Yep.
we were going over ultra processed foods, and one of the dietitians showed us this article about how $40,000 was spent to the food scientists to make sure that the chip was perfectly the perfect crunch, and how
Yep.
it's so absurd. Like, that $40,000 could have fed so many people. And yeah, so it gets me, okay, it gets me frustrated and overwhelmed talking about this kind of stuff, but I also feel very excited. Like, I do have hope for the future of people like you. Like, talking with people like you makes me feel really reassured. You know, there are people putting things into place to, I mean, it's going to take some time. Rome wasn't built in a day,
And I
but
think it's hard.
yeah.
There's a lot of one of the things I worry about, like I don't think this is going to be easy change. And one of the things I really worry about in the US, so I grew up in Canada and lived in Australia for a long time, and there's a lot more government regulation there. And we're seeing like places like Europe and South America putting warning labels for unhealthy food, putting taxes on sugary drinks, regulating a lot more. The US is pretty reluctant to do that because they really support the like a capitalist food system. There's a lot of lobbying. But so I do think this will be hard, and we have good examples of like how hard it was to get trans fat out of the food supply. Like that took 2 decades.
That's
But
crazy.
I think that it kind of gives us a good model of how we can make this change. And I kind of think it's both working with like governments and doing this sort of high level stuff, but they won't do it unless they think consumers and voters want it, right? Like the governments are sort of reluctant to put things in place if they think it's really going to irritate all their voters and make them feel like they're a nanny state and overregulated. So where I think that like the trans fat example is a good example where people voted with their fork and they learned about this like substance that gave people heart disease and they didn't want in their food. And the food industry responds to that. If people start saying, I don't want a bunch of highly processed food, I want better affordable options. And they want to sell food to you and meet your needs. And so I kind of think it's like this dual pressure from both sides of like consumers saying, this is what we want, this is what we don't want. And also as voters and citizens saying like, hey, we want you to make it easier for us to eat healthy. And then some of these big changes can shift more quickly because industry and governments are feel like they're, you know, supported by the power that we have as citizens to push this forward.
Oh yeah, this is empowering. Okay,
yeah.
that's one small thing that we can all do is purchase healthier food and help healthier. Oh man, I just got back from the store actually, and I'm so lucky. I live in such a bubble of absolute amazingness. There's a grocery store called Nude Foods Market. It's a zero waste grocery store. And sure, some things might be more expensive, but I'm so fed up with the food systems that I'm like, so, oh gosh, voting with our dollar. I feel like it's really, really important. And not just for the big global scale of things. I mean, of course, I'm glad to hear that, you know, European countries and Australia, they're a little bit more forward thinking. At least in America, let's vote with our dollar, please, people, if you happen to be able to afford the healthier options, right? The organic options, like seeing next to the checkout line and you see all those candy bars and things. Please, yeah, vote with your dollar. But this also, I loved in the webinar that you were so incredible educating us about the sustainability aspect too, and how that has to do with our health. Like, not only is this voting to make America make shifts in, you know, the policies that are going to make public health better, this is also what's best for public health also happens to be best for the planet, also happens to be best for our health too. Would you mind expanding on that?
Yeah, I think that's been a big realization for me the last few years that I've always talked to families and in the public health space, like, what is healthy eating? Whenever I talk to folks about this, I'm like, it doesn't need to be too complicated. Like, if we made some simple shifts in eating more fruits and vegetables, bit more whole grain and less processed food with salt, sugar, and fat in it, that would make a really big difference in people's lives. Like, just some of those simple things. And when more work started happening about the contributions of our food system to climate change and the environment, and they were realizing, okay, what carbon emissions and what other planetary impacts, like on the soil and water, does our food system have? All of that data now is saying that about a quarter to a third of all greenhouse gas emissions come from our food system. A little bit of that is transportation. It's things like soil degradation, clearing forests to grow things. A big chunk of it is growing food for animals and growing animals for us to eat. And that part of, like, the animal-based products is actually the most inefficient part of our food system that causes kind of the biggest climate impacts. And so there was some work done by a group called the Eat Lancet Commission that's they put out a bunch of reports in 2019. And it was kind of the first time that they're like, let's get a group of people together, not to create diet guidelines that are just for human health, but let's get experts on the environment and human health to come together, and let's create a set of guidelines that have two goals: improve human health and the health of the planet. Because if we don't do that, the planet health is going to get so bad, we literally won't be able to grow food and feed people. So they did that, and they came to this realization that, like, actually a lot of these same things, like eating more fruits and vegetables and more plant-based foods, and reducing our massive overconsumption of animal-based products, which the US is particularly guilty of. We're, like, ranking highest in terms of how much animal products we eat compared to most other countries in the world. If we do that, that benefits both human health and planetary health. Like, there's this dual benefit. So, like, this simple message of, like, eating more fruits and vegetables and plant-based foods, that has all these really great effects for so many different things.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, this is so nuts thinking about this. I'm amazed. Like, I'm amazed that It feels to me very controversial. Like, it's like, oh, you have an agenda if you're telling people to eat less meat, like, I don't know, vegan propaganda or whatever.
Yeah.
But the reality is that, oh, yeah, I like it how you're seeing it from such a broad, like, bird's eye view here, from a this whole country, this our government, like, we're processing too much meat. You know,
yeah.
It's just like taking a step back. And when it comes to what that looks like on our plate, I don't think people necessarily have to stop eating meat altogether, but it's definitely a really, really important message to decrease.
The Eat Lancet Commission that I mentioned, they came out with their own set of dietary guidelines for a healthy planet. So it's sort of like the American dietary guidelines, but it's a healthy planetary diet guideline. And it's like a plate, just like the plate, my plate that comes from the USDA. But the big difference is that it's, they don't say that the recommendation isn't to be vegan or vegetarian or cut out meat altogether. They recognize that we should just have goals and targets that are more aligned with human health and planet health. And so they're healthy planetary plate looks like kind of half the plate is fruits and vegetables, plant-based foods like whole grains, plant-based proteins like beans and pulses, and then small portions of animal product. So they kind of, rather than having a big steak at dinner and sliced meats in your sandwich, you'd have a small portion of animal-based foods maybe two or three times a week. And try to keep that as the target for like lower emissions and better health. And I intentionally didn't say vegan or vegetarian when you asked before, because it means a lot. It means a lot of things to some people, and things about identity, about politics. Mm-hmm. And there was a really interesting study done by my colleague, Wendy Bruin de Bruin, who's at USC, and Patricia Sloboda. And they did this experiment online on a big online survey that has a representative huge group of American households in it. And they showed everybody two food gift baskets. And they're like, we're going to send you, you're going to get in a draw for a gift basket at the end of all this study. You pick which of these two gift baskets you want. And one gift basket was things like salami and cheeses and breads and things. It had animal products in it. The other gift basket was all plant products, things like hummus, olives, some crackers and things. And what they manipulated, or what they randomized, is what the plant-based basket was called. And if they called it a vegan basket or a vegetarian basket, only 20% of folks picked that one. But if they called it a healthy basket or a sustainable basket or a healthy and sustainable basket, it doubled. 40% of folks picked that basket, seeing the same thing. It was just like all about the label. And so what they learned is, like, we can kind of nudge people and help people make maybe more plant-based choices, but using words like vegan and vegetarian is off-putting, will actually get less people like headed in that direction.
This is fascinating. This goes down all the way to, our like primal psychology and branding, and like how we feel a certain way associated with certain words. That's absolutely fascinating. And I presented at the Reducitarian Summit in October last year, and the Reducitarian word, like, I think it's a brilliant concept, especially because there was some, I'm blanking, this is a long time ago I read this study, but it's just unrealistic to expect people to stick to a quote unquote like vegan diet. What the statistics showed was that it's just more likely to be sustained for including a little bit and having it be more plant-based.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. Like, once people label themselves, it's a mind game. Like, once people restrict, and then it's like, oh, screw this, let's go carnivore. You know, it's this crazy like pendulum effect, versus it being, and it's so funny how people want this black and white, like, yes, do this, no, do that, this food is good, this food is bad. But the reality is that we we need to take a step back and see, okay, what's actually for the most people going to be the most sustainable, the most realistic change that we can make, right?
Yeah. I think that rule applies on so many shifts for eating, whether it's eating more sustainably or eating more healthy, that it's, you know, all the really complicated ways of doing that, being super strict, counting your calories, reading labels. Some of us can do that for like a short period of time and be really adherent, but we eat like at least 3 times a day, and it's got to fit into like a million things in our life. And the psychology behind eating has really started recognizing that, like, it's not a decision like once a year you decide if you're going to go get a flu shot. It's a habitual behavior, which means we use the fast part of our brain that's very automated a lot more, because we can't spend that much brain power constantly thinking about what we're eating. So our brains are literally designed to have those like everyday routine behaviors become way more automated. And when they're automated, they are very much influenced by like the cues and the environments and other things around us. Like if you think of when you brush your teeth, it's so routine, you don't really think about it that much. And eating's like a lot like that. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to like keep up this really high level of vigilance and, you know, implementing all these very specific things. Whereas if you just have these kind of simple rules, we often call them heuristics, like kind of these rules of thumb, that's like, okay, I'm going to eat meatless Mondays. I'm going to have smaller portions of meat 2 days a week. Every day, I'm going to try to make half my plate plant-based foods or fruits and vegetables. Those are things that are like way less strict, kind of fit into the world around us, because we got to, you know, go out and live our lives. And they're way more sustainable. Like you can keep them going a lot easier because they can be part of your routines a little more.
Totally. Totally. And fascinatingly, on the webinar that I was so blown away with that you presented, it's not always that the vegan option is the most sustainable option, which was so mind-blowing.
So the science on this is, I mean, there's some big patterns that are really clear. So like in general, plant-based foods have a lot less emissions than animal-based foods.
Beef
so
was like, off the chart.
Beef is off the chart. Beef is really off the chart. And processed red meat, off the chart.
Like, so wait, what was it that was off? It was carbon emissions, right? Carbon emissions.
Yeah. You can Google like carbon emissions in food and you'll probably come up with this kind of big graph that shows beef, lamb, cheese, some key animal-based foods, their carbon emissions are huge. And actually, when I was giving that workshop, my husband overheard it and he's like, what does this really mean? Like, how much emissions are you talking about? Because I don't eat much animal-based food, but he likes to eat more red meat.
Man's man.
And he's like, is it kind of, you know, is it a big deal or not? So he started computing like the amount of carbon emissions from a burger. And he worked out that it's like driving a regular car, something like 300 miles.
Whoa.
And yeah, and we have got an electric vehicle this year to try to reduce our emissions. And he's like, oh man, every time I eat a burger, I might as well be like driving my car halfway across California. Wow. So beef and red meat's like huge. And then if you get down to more like some fish-based products, more grain products, and then really like low on the chart is like fruits and vegetables, really minimal emissions. But like you were saying, sometimes it's a bit complicated. Like there's a study actually that came out this week looking at carbon emissions from urban farming. And the assumption has been like, oh, urban farming, like community gardens and urban farms are probably way better for the environment than large scale farming. But what they found is actually, no, it's not true. And it really depends. So there was all this nuance that like they just kind of needed to get to the details of. So for some big industrial farms, they were actually had less emissions and less environmental impact than the urban farms. But if there was large scale farming that relied on greenhouses or a long transportation, like bananas flying all over the world, then like local farming was a better practice, and the urban farms were actually like more sustainable and less emissions than community gardens. And it's a lot, but I think that it's kind of the point of like, there's a bit of complexity in this. Like, it matters how long you fly things, if it's clearing forest for that crop or not.
Right.
Coffee and chocolate are actually really high in emissions. They were kind of up there with the red meat. And part of that is that, you know, lots of forest land gets cleared for these, and there's planes and all kinds of transportation shipping them around the world. So there's a bit of complexity that makes it confusing and a little bit difficult, but there's also these heuristics, these like simple rules of thumb that like reducing animal-based food, especially red meat, by a bit and having smaller portions and less frequently could have a really big impact. Like, that's for sure.
Gosh, this is super interesting. Sorry, my mind is stuck on the word chocolate and coffee. I'm sure people are like, wait a second, because it's true. Here I am being as integrity as I possibly can be, trying to eat as locally, you know, trying to be zero waste, most of course, mostly plant-based. But yeah, I love dark chocolate, and I'm sure a lot of people like coffee, and this dark chocolate, who knows where it's actually grown. Like, I used to live in Hawaii, and cacao trees actually grow in Hawaii, but here in Colorado, definitely not so much. Definitely.
Yeah.
And I was always confused. Like, I was like, how is Switzerland so famous for their chocolate? There's no way any cacao grows anywhere near here. So even if you think you're eating local chocolate, there's no way that that cacao bean was actually grown there, probably.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, but I digress.
Yeah.
I would
Yeah.
Actually,
no, I think it's a good point. And also, I mean, the other thing I'd say is like, if you're a big meat eater, if you think of like all the amount of meat you might eat over a week relative to the amount of chocolate, I think our chocolate intake is usually somewhat smaller portions. Hopefully it is, because like it's a delicious thing, but like in small amounts. So I think like it's important to think about, you know, the sourcing and where your food comes from, but also eating things in small moderation and just being mindful of that, where you're, you know, indulging in something that's delicious and but maybe less healthy or less sustainable.
Right. Yeah, I definitely have not made an actual meal out of a couple of chocolate bars. You know, I am curious though to hear the difference between the urban and the industrial farming. I don't have a clear picture. I'm not sure what these exactly are, what that means.
So I learned about this more recently too. So when I was working more with local government and community organizations on how do we help LA County have a healthier, sustainable food system, one of the things a lot of folks were talking about was local urban farming. And there's some really cool groups in LA. Crop Swap is one of them. And they have a lot of goals. Like, one of their goals is that the industrial food system is so corporate and it doesn't provide very good equity and rights to people growing food. And it actually takes that power out of communities' hands. So if you think about the COVID pandemic and the fact that we were waiting for things on our shelves, that the corporate food system was throwing out milk because it was packaged for schools, not for, you know, grocery sales use. They have all these efficiencies and a lot of control out of how food gets supplied. And we saw shortages in LA County with like a lot of bare shelves. And so one of the goals I hear these urban farmers talk about is like, we want to take back some of the ownership of our food supply locally. And there's a lot of work in LA County around communities of color taking that back in, because they've been really excluded from like the massive profit of the food industry. So some of their goals are to like reclaim some local land, use available space, bring farmers in, or have folks that are farming like grow food locally, and they distribute it locally, and they have a lot of control over their food supply. They make the profits stay local, and they leverage like a lot of people's skills and resources, and they can grow healthy food and distribute it. So it's kind of a really cool model for a number of different reasons. And I think one of the other reasons is like it kind of, you know, we are so detached from where our food comes from. Like we just get these like very packaged mini carrots at the grocery store or delivered to our door from an Amazon robot even. And so this like brings food back to like kids and families and communities can like see where it's grown. They can participate in that. Like it does, I think, a lot of kind of amazing things. But one of the things they were talking about in LA was like, how, you know, could this contribute to a more sustainable food system for us? Not just all those other benefits I was talking about, but it should shorten the supply chain. You know, we're not driving foods all over the place. So there's been a lot of interest in it. But I think what this study that came out showed is that it's not so simple. It's not necessarily that like if a bunch of vegetables are grown locally, that the carbon emissions is going to be less than if they were grown in the valley in California, where there's big industrial farming that do it pretty efficiently and then transport it to LA. But kind of the devil is in the details. Like it, so the things that mattered is like, well, is that industrial farming using big greenhouses? And are they just transporting locally on trains, or is this getting flown around the world? And so the kind of the answer from that study was like, well, local and urban farming in terms of greenhouse gas emissions is not necessarily better. It can be, but it depends on a bunch of things. But if you think about the bigger picture, like, is this something we want to invest in and do? Maybe for sustainability in some cases, but probably for a lot of other reasons, for like connecting people to their food system and bringing more control of the food supply locally.
Wow, fascinating. I would assume that, yeah, the urban would be like so much better. So that's really, really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think if you think about the industrial food system, like the one thing it got really good at is producing a lot of food efficiently. Like that's how it makes a profit. And so a lot of pretty amazing technology has been developed to like efficiently, quickly grow food and get it to everyone's like that's we can feed this huge population on our planet largely because of that food system. But it's been prioritized to be efficient and profitable, not healthy and sustainable. Yeah.
Like, wouldn't that be sprayed and like depleting the soil? And just in the long term, it seems like it would probably be really less positive all around. That's
Yeah, there's a lot of complexity. I think you're talking about not just carbon emissions, but like what about some other factors like soil degradation or the water supply? So yeah, these things all, there's a lot of things to look at in the equation.
Oh, I'm curious with all you know so much. On the day to day to, keep your sanity, is there anything that you personally practice or that you personally intend to live by? I heard you saying that you eat mostly plant-based, or like if you happen to have tips like that, like realistic, tangible tips that maybe we're not working on the policy like you are, but if there are any lifestyle factors you might be able to touch on.
Yeah, I think, I mean, some of the things I try to think about in my day-to-day food choices are, so one, I mostly eat plant-based foods and I've done that for a couple of decades and the reasons have changed for me over time. And now I feel like for me, this is a really good choice for my health, for like my heart health and my longevity. And also for the health of the planet, it feels like a good decision. And so when I cook at home, I mostly cook plant-based things. And I would say it took me quite a while. Like, so I grew up in rural Canada in a farming area that's like known for its beef farming and great steaks. And no one is vegetarian. And so when I started eating more plant-based food, I was not eating very healthy. I was eating like a Caesar salad with a pizza pocket or something. That was like, yeah. So for me, it's been like really educating myself about, especially from different cultures. Like there's so many cultures that eat almost all of the cultures around the world outside of where we live, like, eat way more plant-based food. So that's actually been a really fun thing to, like, explore foods from different places that are healthy, that have protein from beans and legumes, and eating more whole grains. So that's something I think about, and definitely the sustainability thing I've started thinking about a lot more, both in terms of, like, the foods I pick and trying to buy stuff. Like, one habit I got into last year was I just ordered a couple little mesh bags on Amazon, and I use those to get all my fruit and vegetable now. So I don't use, like, single-use plastics. And then I just throw them in that, and there's all those nice, like, nice little silicone bags. You can put your stuff in the fridge. And I was like, oh, I've really reduced, like, my waste of plastic around that. And thinking about, like, not wasting food. I think that was the other big thing that, in all the work I've done the last couple of years on sustainability in food, is that, and actually this is, like, kind of blew me away. So I was working a lot with families that are food insecure, and I do a lot of work to track food insecurity locally. And, like, 1 in 3 households go hungry currently in LA. It's really crazy. And we have, you know, we have plenty of food for everyone. It's not like the US is a country. We actually have more calories than we need per person per day. And the other thing we do in LA County is throw out 1/3 of edible food, and that causes greenhouse gas emissions. So, like, that whole thing is just, like, what? This ridiculous. Is nuts, right?
Yeah.
And so there's amazing work happening in this. The local governments have started making rules that you're not, as a restaurant or retailer, not allowed to throw out edible food anymore. So that went into place this year. And then because of that, all these cool companies popped up to, like, start reclaiming edible food and capture it. And they have apps, and they'll pick it up from your business, and then they'll get it to the pantry. So, like, Food Forward is this one really cool company in LA that they've actually been doing this for decades and just grown and grown and grown. And so their whole business is just, like, grab all the edible food and, like, get it to the people who need it. And then it doesn't end up in landfill.
I love that.
Yeah, that part's, that's so cool. And I think a lot more about food waste, like, not trying not to overbuy and throw things out, and making sure I'm not contributing to that. But the other practice I'd have that I think is, like, the thing I like the most around my food practice is I shop at my farmers markets a lot. And I feel like I get local food. It's fresher, it's healthy. I can, you know, I have the ability to buy organic, which is, like, really, a privilege right now in the US, and should be more accessible to folks, or be able to buy local farm fresh food. But the other big piece of it for me is, like, I love connecting with people there. Like, it's the one place that I'm, you know, I see my neighbors, I hear about what's happening on the local council or with, like, some housing sale that went, but then I talk to the farmers and, like, hear about if they got rain this week and what's in season, and I can buy a lot of in season food. And so that's, like, one place where I feel like, okay, I can buy local, sustainable, plant-based stuff, and really, like, have all these social connections, like, ticks all these boxes for me. And it's, like, one of my favorite things to do. Like, I'll
go outside, you know,
schedule that in my calendar every week. Like, I block my meetings around it so I can, like, go to the farmer's market.
As you should. Oh, man. Yeah. If you happen to have a local farmer's market, please, yeah, support that. I lived in LA for a while, and I miss the year-long markets. Like,
yeah,
you're here. I don't think it starts until April. I miss it so much. That's my happy place, you know?
And that is a privilege of LA, year long.
And I definitely have given the stink eye to people who buy, you know, one pepper and they put it in a plastic bag. I'm like, you don't need that. You don't need to do that. Like, why are you putting it in a plastic bag? I like to circle back around, like, thinking about all of these different lifestyle factors, and hearing that your husband was like, wait a second, you know, how do you navigate in relationship around these different lifestyle factors?
So one of the first thing I studied when I was studying, like, psychology and nutrition was social influence on eating, how the people around you influence what you eat. And at the time, my boyfriend was Australian, and I wasn't eating much meat, and I was like living in this place without meat. And so I've thought a lot about how I'm influenced by people around me and what they're eating, and how I might be an influence on other people. And I think, I mean, LA is probably the easiest place to navigate eating plant-based food.
The best vegan food in the world, I think.
Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah. And there's always options. And I think almost anywhere, though, this is true, where, so the classic example is like, if you order a coffee and you want oat milk or some non-animal based milk product, they upcharge you still everywhere,
yeah.
Which I find is just that. And so, and there's still other things like the Impossible Burger is an extra charge. Or if you are on a road trip and you're getting, you know, you need to, the only thing around is like fast food, often the salad or isn't great, or it's more expensive, or they don't even have those options. And so, yeah, I think the, you know, the challenge of it in your day-to-day life is hard, but in terms of people around me, I guess I've never tried to impose it on people, but I definitely invite a lot of people over for dinners.
There you
and
go.
I don't, you know, I don't tell them it's plant-based, and I'm like spaghetti bolognese with lentils, or Impossible Burger, or like this, I made this great shepherd's pie last week and invited some Australian friends around, and it was made from lentils and mushrooms. And people, you know, when they eat delicious food, they eat delicious food. And I think it does, you know, kind of, we're so influenced by what's around us. Like if you're one person doing something a bit differently, I think other people see it and they're like, oh, that looks interesting, or not so bad, or that tastes great, or.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. That sounds so good. Yeah, that's a great way to make friends and to be like accidentally, you know, inspiring people. Gosh, yeah, I'm just in the dating world, and I really, really liked this guy, and he ate a lot of bacon. And I literally said to him, kind of like offhandedly, like not really thinking about it, like, I don't know if I could date a guy that
eat so much bacon.
Yeah, and
it's funny, I've found with guys I've lived with, like they might eat a lot of bacon, but then when we've lived together, I'm like, well, you can eat meat, go for it, but I'm not buying it or cooking it. And pretty much all of them have stopped eating meat at home because they can't be, they're like, okay, that's fine. I'll just eat plant.
Yeah, maybe I should have stuck it out, and then once we moved in together, then the values is tough, you know.
yeah, but it is. I do think it's like a big part of a lot of cultures. Like I definitely grew up in a culture where like people thought it was like really unhealthy not to eat meat. And actually, like the one person who was a vegetarian that anyone knew in my town was Katie Lang. She grew up like where I grew up, and she had left and become vegetarian, and everyone was like, what, like that's so crazy, what is she doing? And
wow.
So there's a lot, you know, you have, but people grew up with all of this understanding of like what's healthy, what's normal,
really,
what's, you know, what supports your local culture and economy. And you know, that stuff like really sticks with you, right? And so I think it is kind of a gradual thing of like getting used to new and different ideas, especially around food, because our palates, our taste buds, our identities are like all tied to this. It's not something we can just like throw away very easy.
Definitely. Yeah. Oh, it feels so good to connect with you today. Thank you so much for dropping all of this wisdom.
Thanks, Katie.
Is there anything that we didn't touch upon that you feel called to educate about and share about?
I think the other thing we haven't talked so much about that's like a big focus of the work I do is around like inequality. So there's just like such big gaps in the diet quality and the health in things like diabetes for communities that are low income, a lot of communities of color in the US, for a whole bunch of complicated historical reasons. And so I do think that's really an important thing to think about when we think of all this stuff, like what's accessible to who? Are the changes that we're making really going to benefit everyone? And some of the things I worry about I'm working on a precision nutrition study right now where we're trying to identify like individual responses to diet. And a lot of things I worry about is like, okay, this is great. It's new science, it's new information, but like, who can really use this? Like all those families I worked with that struggle to like just get enough food for their kids, and their kids often have hunger issues. Like this isn't going to benefit them. And so I do think we have to like keep that really front of mind. Like we need a system that's really, if we're going to make changes, it's got to like benefit everybody and not leave a bunch of people behind.
Oof, that's so big. I'm curious if there's anything that I can do, that our listeners can do, to either help move policy move forward, or like any links that I could share, or any suggestions just in general that we could do to help with this gap. Like, is there?
Yeah, there's lots. There's, you know, locally, there's always lots of like food advocacy, food justice groups. So if you have groups like that in your community, food banks help so many people out when they're in a crisis mode. Like those places are great to help and put your energy or time or money into. But like at the bigger level, things like, there's a lot happening in DC and at the state levels right now around the farm bill, which has a lot to do with how much money people who get SNAP or food stamps get. There's all these cool programs like giving people extra money for food when they shop at the farmers markets to buy fruit and vegetables. There's a whole food as medicine initiative helping low-income folks get prescriptions for healthy food. But a lot of this stuff is on chopping blocks, and there's like budget cuts happening to it. And so there, as much momentum as we can get to like, if any way you get involved in politics through like your local people or DC people, or even tweeting saying like, hey, I don't want money cut from these programs that like just help people get healthy food that need it. That sort of pressure, like we just need a lot more louder voices around that right now.
Wow. I love hearing that. Literally, we have so much at our fingertips, like sending a tweet, maybe sending a DM, like sending something like that actually can move a needle. That's really, really cool.
Oh, that's and then like vote with your fork.
Vote with your fork. Oh, so good.
And that's not my quote. That's Marion Nestle. She's an amazing food writer and nutritionist, and she comes up with some great lines that are powerful.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much. Gosh, I so acknowledge all that you do. I really, like I said before, I feel like a lot of people don't like to look at these problems because it is overwhelming, or it can be overwhelming. You know, sometimes people, just the news, just all of this stuff going on. And it's beautiful to be so inspired by someone like you, to be so empowered, like, oh my gosh, there's actually hope, there's things happening, the needle is moving, we can, like, oh man, I'm just so grateful for you. I love that you shared so much research. You're not just sharing your own personal stories here, like you really were able to speak to a lot of facts, a lot of data, a lot of things going on. And there's so much I want to ask you. I'm like, wait, coming from Canada and Australia, and now you're advocating so much for the US policy. Like, I'm sure you have so many stories and so much more to share. And I really, really appreciate your time. I have one more final question for you. Curious, how do you empower yourself? How do you feed your power?
Working with amazing people. I love working in teams. I work with amazing students. I work with amazing colleagues. But some of the most inspiring people I've worked with the last couple of years have been people working in the local government who like work really hard and really try to make change happen, and community organizations. Like the number of amazing leaders and community organizations who are working a ton, have done all this work in the last few years to like try to address this food crisis and so many folks that are food insecure, and try to make the food system better. Working in these teams is like, gives me so much energy.
I love that. That's so cool. And that's, that empowers and inspires me so much. There's, you're not the only superhero. Like, I hope that you have a team of
There's a
superheroes.
big team.
That's so cool. I love it so much. Well, thank you again for your time. And yeah, everyone, let's vote with our forks.
Yeah. Thanks, Katie.
I hope you enjoyed this one. Let me know what you think. Hit me up on Instagram at vitamin.katie. Any suggestions, any takeaways? I would absolutely love to hear. Take it easy. Take a deep breath. Let's make little changes. All of the little things add up. It doesn't have to be a total overhaul. Rome wasn't built in a day, okay? So give yourself some credit. Seriously, thank you for listening to this at all. Those of us who are willing to, instead of listen to music and just jam out or whatever, to instead to be educated with something like this, that's huge. Give yourself some credit. Let me know what you think, and I hope you have an absolutely incredible day. Thank you for dedicating time to improve your health and your life by listening to this podcast. If you are interested in holistic health and nutritional counseling, click the link in my bio to apply. Don't forget to screenshot this and tag me at vitamin.katie on your Instagram story, subscribe to this podcast, and leave a review to get this message out there to help more people. Thanks again so much for listening, and have a beautiful, wonderful, incredible life. Much love to you. Bye.